This episode is sponsored by the PVS Studio team. PVS Studio Code Analyzer performs code analysis and issues warnings on code with a high probability of having bugs and potential vulnerabilities. The tool supports C, C++, C Sharp, and Java, and it can work with Visual C++, GCC, Clang compilers, and some of those for embedded systems. The analyzer works on Windows, Linux, and Mac OS, and can be used as a standalone tool and integrated within Visual Studio, IntelliJ, SonarQube, and more. Find links to the PVS Studio website in the show notes at sixfiguredev.com. Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Olivia Liddell. Olivia Liddell is a cloud training specialist at CloudBakers. She is a former Chicago Public Schools teacher who now specializes in technology training and change management. Welcome, Olivia.
Thank you all so much for having me here.
So before we get started, would you just, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of your path into the industry?
Yeah, absolutely. Going all the way back to when I was a kid on AOL, about 11, 12 years old, I got into a little bit of hacking, downloading software programs that I probably should not have, and doing a little bit of malicious things, but also investigating how things worked, figuring out how to code and building websites. And all of that stayed with me as I got into my career as a public schools teacher. I always had this curiosity myself about things, and I used that as I was working with my students. But even though when I was teaching non-technical things, like I taught middle school Arabic for a number of years, I was always looking for ways to combine teaching with technology. So for example, I would train other teachers at the school on how to use Google Sites. I figured out that my students wanted to learn more about numbers, but they were also really into video games, as I am. Nothing out there existed. So I decided to create my own original Arabic computer game for them. At a certain point, I'm seeing the pattern here. Like, I'm into teaching people things. I also really like technology. Why don't I put the two together? And now with the work that I do at CloudBakers here in Chicago, I'm one of our technical trainers. So we partner with different customers who are moving into various cloud platforms like G Suite. And it's really rewarding to sit down with people and help them to see, here's what your new workflow is like. Let me help you see the ins and outs of that. So a lot of that patience is there, but also still having the need for a solid technical foundation.
So what's been the most challenging part in transitioning from public schools into being a trainer for technologists?
Yeah, this is something where I'm seeing a lot of this now with some of my colleagues who are still in the public school system and are looking to transition out. A lot of it, as with any industry, but especially education, is that so much of what you do and the way that your resume has to be written for a teacher, it's drastically different than what you need in other industries. So for example, as an educator, you may have a resume where you include metrics about students' test scores, the number of lesson plans that you would write, the number of students that you would serve. And for many people who are transitioning out, and this was something I struggled with myself initially too, figuring out a way to make it so that the work and the skills that you bring as a teacher, you're showing how that's transferable to other industries as well. And I was really fortunate that this relates pretty well to this topic, that I had some mentors who helped me to take a step back and see beyond what I was doing in my day-to-day. Because then they're saying, Olivia, you've got a lot of skills. Don't sell yourself short and make yourself think that teaching is all that you can do. So I think that's probably been the biggest transition point for me, like really trying to take a step back and think about, of all the things that I'm doing as a teacher, how can I apply that to other contexts and still show the value in what I'm bringing to the table?
Growing up, I was a horrible student. I am sure that all of my teachers hated me. Aww. And looking back into that, I feel kind of bad about that because I actually enjoyed them. It was just the the environment wasn't for me, and I didn't make use of it the way that I could have and probably should have. With that, I did go into a computer science program, but ended up dropping out and moving into the workforce pretty early. And a lot of people, I think, have followed that same tradition and consider themselves self-taught. And I used to mention and consider myself to be self-taught as well. But I think more and more these days, I consider myself having been taught by a number of different mentors.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It's this balance between having what we consider like self-efficacy, being able to know, to feel the motivation to pick up something new on your own, to explore it, to figure out how it works, why does it work in a certain way, but then also knowing that you have the support of someone else who can help guide you. Like even the best mentor in the world is not going to do all the work for you. So I think that, in my experience as a mentor, is a really tough point to strike, because from the mentoring side of things, I want to naturally help people. I want to see someone else do well, but I also don't want to take away from that part of them where I know that they need to do some of that upfront work to spark their own curiosity and to ensure that they are bringing something to the table, and then I can pick up from there and help fill in the missing gaps that they're looking for.
Having a child of my own now, I have gained a phenomenal amount of patience that I didn't have many years ago. So I've taken that into work when I'm training and working with people that are younger in their career or younger in their age, or just someone that's trying to pick up a new skill or a different technology.
Yeah, patience is so much of what I do. And I tell people all the time, from being a middle school teacher, that will teach you all the patience in the world that you need. And it's but what I feel so grateful for is that the teacher residency program that I went through here in Chicago, it helped instill in me this idea that regardless of someone's age or background, when someone is a beginner to something, you need to take a similar approach to really break it down for them in a certain methodical way. We use strategies like what's called scaffolding, meaning that you give a little bit more support to them in the beginning. You check to see how they're doing as they become better at it. Over time, you pull back that scaffold so that they can fly on their own. And there are so many things that I do as a trainer now that when people ask me, "Oh, Olivia, how did you know how to train us in that way? This was so effective. What's your secret?" And I'll say, coming from having taught about 500 middle schoolers, that I do the exact same thing. I just don't give out detention slips anymore. That is the difference. But so much of it carries over. And I think that when it comes to training people on technology, you really do have to be patient. You have to go into it not assuming that someone is at a certain skill level, because as a trainer, one of the most important things that I have to be is approachable. I also have to be trustworthy, and for people to feel that they can come to me and say, "I don't know this. Can you help me?" As opposed to me coming across as high and mighty, like I know everything, because then I'm making it so that they're never going to want to talk to me. But I need them to be able to see me as someone who doesn't know all the answers, but can also knows enough to be able to guide them through. And it's one of the most challenging parts of my job, but it's something that I love so much.
I feel like that really ties into the mentorship aspect of things, because those are pretty much effectively some of the same things and some of the same approaches that trying to be a good mentor, you have to kind of exhibit those relationships, that approachability. You know, our industry really does thrive on the people that have kind of learned from their mentors. And that's where the majority, even if you've gotten a college education, a lot of times it's, you know, what you've learned from, you know, your experience with the developer sitting next to you that really drives your success and, you know, advancement and understanding. So how can we refine those skill sets, and what are some of the things that we can kind of look for to try to help improve ourselves being mentors?
Yeah, that is. I was thinking about that this morning. That's when all the great ideas come to me, apparently. And I think one thing that can be particularly challenging for mentors, especially those who are newer to it, who are very excited, who want to make a difference, and who see potential in others, is that you want to help someone else grow and thrive, but the challenge is that you don't want to make that person a clone of you. Because when you have someone that you're mentoring, your role as a mentor is to, I'm going to say the word empathy a lot because it rings true to so many things. You have to have that empathy to put yourself in their shoes and see, where are they coming from? What are they trying to get out of this mentoring relationship? And based on that, what can you as their mentor do to help shape and guide them, but to not necessarily do it in a way that's making them a clone of you? Because it's easy to say, well, in my personal and professional background, this is what I went through. This is what I struggled with. This is what I learned from this. And therefore, I can package all of that up and give that to my mentee and have them internalize that and learn something from me. But the challenge and the beauty of mentoring, I think, is to have someone in front of you that you can try to match what they're looking for, especially in terms of skill development, to be able to refine that in the way that they may be looking to grow. Or if they don't yet know which direction they're looking to grow in, you can be a source of giving them options. I make a lot of food metaphors. So it's almost like you want that waiter or the waitress who can help you do some good food pairings to say, hey, you're starting with this course of cheese. Here's a good wine that may go with that. And you think, wow, you really know your stuff. It's not that they're saying, I'm only telling you the thing that is my personal preference, but based on where I see that you're going and based on my professional expertise, here's the direction that I think may be good for you, because there's a lot of trust that goes into that. Now I'm hungry.
So you're like a tech sommelier.
Exactly. Yeah. Y'all should see in the trainings that I do, there are so many food metaphors. I have a metaphor for everything. And it helps because sometimes with really high technical concepts, people may wonder, well, what are you talking about? Where is this coming from? But it's another way of communication. And once people have that aha moment, first of all, they think I'm a little bit weird. So that's great. But then also they understand something better. And it comes back to that idea that I was talking about that is so important in mentoring. Being approachable and relatable. Because if you feel that you can't, as a mentee, so on the other side, if you have a mentor that is so skilled and qualified, but you as a mentee feel that you can't speak with them or you're too intimidated by them, then the mentee is never going to get any value out of that. Hmm. So it's like a missed opportunity.
In the past, when I've tried to mentor some people, I've had the experience where I see that they're dealing with a problem and I don't want them to deal with quite as much pain as I had to when dealing with that same problem. And so I try to kind of shortcut their pain and like point them in a direction or sometimes hand them the answer. And that normally doesn't work very well. Kind of like that you learn better from failure than you do from success kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then in other cases, you can just, oh, well, here's how you would solve that problem and everything's fine. How do you recognize which one is which way, and then how do you guide someone through, I guess, their failure without giving them the answer?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I've got a good example of this I'll tell y'all about. The short version of it is that I think as a mentor, as much as possible, you want to assess the situation to see if you do decide to let your mentee, like, let's say, experience this fully, even though you have a suspicion that they may end up failing. Think about how big of a deal will it be if they don't get it right the first time? Like, if this is the most crucial project they're working on and you are seeing something that you can get ahead of and give them a heads up about, if it's a very crucial project, then I would probably say err on the side of giving them slightly more guidance. But if it's more of a project where they're working on it on the side and they're feeling things out and still learning about some key fundamentals of how to put things together, then you can give them more of a buffer to say, go play with this. Let me know how it works out for you. Then you can have more of an open conversation about it. The story I want to tell y'all about this is when I was going through my residency teaching year in a third grade classroom, it was myself, another resident teacher, and our mentor teacher. So there are three teachers, myself included, in the classroom. And the way it was set up was that as a student resident teacher, you would start by giving smaller lessons early in the year And then when you became more experienced as a teacher, you work your way up to teaching the entire day and the entire week. So I was tasked with teaching what was supposed to be a 5-minute lesson on multiplication, 5 minutes, get the lesson out there, and then send the kids off to work in their workshops and then bring them back together. I was doing so great. I was crushing it. I was like patting myself on the back and thinking, these kids are learning. Everything's going great. Turns out I was talking for like 45 minutes. So if you can imagine a classroom of third graders, so eight and 9 year olds who thought that they were going to be getting up and moving around for after 5 minutes, and they've been sitting there for 45. But here's the thing. My mentor teacher was watching the whole time. She could have stopped me. She totally could have jumped in to say, oh, all right, thank you so much, Miss Liddell. Let's move on to the rest of our lives. But she didn't stop me. And at the very end, when I looked at the time and realized, oh, okay, that was 45 minutes instead of five, when we debriefed, she said, I intentionally let you keep going because, like I was saying earlier, it wasn't a big deal. Nothing, no harm was caused by these children being lectured for 45 minutes about multiplication. At least I hope not. But she said, I needed you to feel what that felt like, and I need you to not do that again. And so that I'm really glad that she did that, because even to this day, and like I was doing some trainings just the other day, because of how she mentored me in that way and coached me, I still use that when I'm relying on my now internal clock as far as my timing goes. Because when I'm doing some trainings for a customer, if there's a section that needs to be 5 minutes, I can't go for 45. But had she stopped me there, I wouldn't have developed that internal skill that I really need to be able to know what that feels like. And I still thank her to this day. I say, Sarah, you know what? I don't know if you remember that, but she's like, yeah, I do. So who could not forget that? Yeah. But does that answer your question there, like knowing that balance in between?
Yeah.
If you ever want to learn about multiplication for a very extended period of time, I'm your expert.
So at Cloud Bakers, you said that you train your clients on moving things into the cloud, into various cloud providers. How much time do you spend training on the technologies versus some of these communication skills and any of the lacking thoughts or things that they need to be successful?
Yeah, most of it does tend to be on the technical side. So for example, we tend to have a lot of our customers who've been in platforms like Microsoft Outlook, Office 365, and then their company is making the decision to move into G Suite. So using Gmail, using Google Drive, and I will help them to understand, here's how this transitions over into your new workflow. Even going beyond saying, click here, do that. A lot of it for me is listening to them first to figure out what do they need to know. And through that, I feel that I'm always teaching people about a lot of these things that you're saying, like about the communication piece of it through the process of me teaching them how to work in a new platform. And I deal with all types of people. I mean, there are some who will come to me sweet as could be, others who will just like woke up on the wrong side of the bed in so many different ways. And, when I'm working with them, it's in a very short-term basis. So I'm working with them during that training moment and possibly a little bit later on down the line for extended trainings as needed. So I can't necessarily change someone's communication right away, but I feel that one of the great benefits of training is being able to show people through my actions how it is that they can try to internalize some of that themselves too, like what it looks like when they need to ask someone for help. I'm very open and honest when someone asks me something that I don't know the answer to. So then I'll say, you know, that's a really great question. Here's how I would go about trying to find the answer. Here's how I would go about trying to ask someone else what I'm looking for. So teaching people those kinds of skills. And what I love about it that comes from my background as a teacher is that it's one of those ninja skills where people don't realize I'm teaching them things, but they're getting the lesson anyway. And then they'll come away from like, oh, wow, I feel like a better person now. Like, that's right, you do. You just got Olivia-fied.
That's fantastic. Well, actually, on the topic of listening, that was one of the main things that I took away from your talk that you recently did, was the listen before you speak, sort of going into the different kinds of active listening, paraphrasing, clarifying, and giving feedback. Those the different sort of steps that you can do to sort of actively listen or and communicate the fact that you have been. Could you kind of go into a little bit of that as it applies to mentorship?
Yeah, absolutely. As I was sketching out this talk on mentoring, I really had to sit down with it and ask myself, what is the first thing that comes into play here? And I know so many people who came into that talk wanting to learn about mentoring, in their mind, they're picturing one person on the on one side of the table, the mentor on the other side, and the mentor is giving all their life knowledge and talking and talking. And people will picture it as being a very mentor heavy driven relationship and conversation. And as I was reflecting back on all of the mentoring experiences that I've had personally, for better or worse, the ones that I really took so much away from were the ones where the person who was mentoring me stopped and asked me first, what was on my mind? What did I want to know about? Even when I was interviewing for my job here at Cloud Bakers last year, our CTO really threw me off guard when he sat me down and said, all right, we've got, I think, half an hour. First question I have for you is, what questions do you have for me? And thank goodness I came prepared. But then also, I think it's the active listening comes into play, because before you, as the mentor on that side, before you can start saying anything, you really need to think about, where is that person coming from? The empathy side again. How are they feeling about the topic that they're wanting to discuss? I think one of the examples I gave during the talk at CodeMash was, let's say your mentee comes to you and they say, all right, I'm working on this new project. And if they keep it there, and if you as the mentor assume like, oh, that's great, let's talk about that. But if the mentee follows up and says, I'm actually kind of freaked out about this, so that's why I'm here to talk to you now. The active listening comes into play, because you really want to hear what people are saying first before you try to make assumptions and give them advice. So beyond that, there may be times when you may not fully understand. So it connects into paraphrasing back to them what you understood. And I like to say paraphrasing, not parroting. So if you repeat back word for word, that's a little bit like, okay, you were really listening to me. so you don't have to be very literal with it. But in the slides that I put together, I have some sentence starters, things like, what I hear you saying is dot, 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 or it sounds to me that you're saying. And part of what I like to encourage people with mentoring is that it is absolutely okay to use sentence starters. This is something I use that comes from my background in the classroom, where if we have some students who are struggling with writing in particular, and they're struggling with getting their writing off the ground, and they almost become stuck because they don't want to move forward, giving them that kind of scaffolded assistance of start here. And over time, the better you get with it as a mentor, you're not going to need those sentence starters anymore. It's going to come to you naturally. But then you can ask those questions to clarify. What did you mean when you say this? Or what can I tell you more about? Ultimately, all of that is like the information gathering phase. I'm thinking about hacking, sorry, reconnaissance. I mean, you can do recon on your mentee too, but but in this case, you know, you're gathering the pieces together, because from the mentee's perspective, the fact that you are taking the time to really listen to them, to hear them out before you start giving them advice, it really makes them feel a lot more valued and appreciated.
For the last week, I've been sort of mentally preparing for this conversation, because I knew we were going to have you on, and have been giving it a lot of thought since I'm in my 20th year of professional development, mostly been doing line of business applications. So I've been solving the same types of problems for 20 years. The technology at this point is not the challenge to me. It's the interaction with my colleagues, with the business folks, with the people that are asking for the product. Since I'm in the numerous years of my career, I've kind of seen as a de facto leader of sorts on the technology side, at least. But being 100% introvert every time I take a Myers-Briggs type test, it's very difficult for me to be open and have those communications with my colleagues. It's very difficult to be an active listener and actually participate in that. So That's something that I've identified in myself long ago and continue to work on it and to try to improve so that I can be a better team member and communicate better with everyone in my surroundings.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, believe it or not, no one ever believes this about me. I'm an introvert too. I attend and speak at a lot of tech conferences, but once I finish speaking, I spend a certain amount of time kind of holed up in my own little dark area. It's not helping that the background here is like a little dark interrogation room. But one of the pieces of advice that I have for other fellow introverts or even people who may be more extroverted and outgoing but aren't quite sure how to get started, what helped me a lot was starting by refining my communication through writing first and really using that as an initial jumping off point for getting my ideas out there. Because I find that sometimes when I'm in the situation of being in a face-to-face or a spoken interaction, the pressure is on like right then and there, and you can tense up, you freeze up. And before you know it, you're not quite sure what to say. You might say something where you feel like you put your foot in the mouth. And then beyond that, I will often look back on interactions that didn't go so well, and I replay them in my mind. And that makes me less likely to want to get out there and do it again in the future. And so for anyone who can relate to that, starting in writing is such a great way to scaffold yourself into that, because you have so much more time to get your ideas out there, sketch them out, pore over them and think, what is this really saying? How is this coming? How might this come across to the other person? Even getting feedback from someone else, if you want to bounce some ideas off of them. And over time, those additional supports that you need, like the additional time that you need or having other eyes look at it, you're able to get those ideas out yourself in writing. And over time, I believe that the writing part of it will start to connect over to the spoken side of it. And this, again, is one of those approaches where sometimes people will say to me in the context of mentoring, but is that okay? Like, is it all right to mentor someone through Slack or through email? Ideally, it's not going to be exclusively like that. But ultimately, when you're looking at the overall outcome of wanting to do things like you're saying, of promote a certain kind of leadership quality and ensure that your team members are feeling supported and cared for, if you feel that the best way that you can do that at the moment is through writing, I think that that is an absolutely valid way of doing it, knowing that you're working towards that goal of helping people and also making those improvements yourself over time.
A little bit to add to that, you posed the question, is it okay to mentor somebody over Slack or email? In my professional career, the majority of my mentors have been somebody on the internet in a video. For anybody who's listening, that's perfectly okay to remote mentor. You have no idea how many people you could help by sharing your experience or teaching something that you know in the best way that you can.
I absolutely agree. One thing too with Twitter, there's the hashtag Mentoring Monday that comes up every Monday. It's an initiative people have put together to be able to get people more exposure to mentoring, and it works a number of ways. If you're someone who is wanting to be a mentor and you have certain specific skill sets that you are you feel that you're good at, and this is one of the things I talked about in my talk at CodeMash, like, really be specific in what you feel that you can coach someone on. You see people on this hashtag Mentoring Monday thread saying, here's what I can offer. If you're interested, DM me and we can start a connection there. Again, all through text initially. On the other side, you have people who are wanting to learn more about, let's say, unit testing, or they're wanting to get more into developing a pair programming initiative at their company, and they're not sure how to do these things. So they're offering up what they are looking to learn more about. And it's just amazing to see those matches come together, all of it starting through text. And I feel that text, whether it's through Twitter or Slack or email, it's such a valid way of having to communicate. And that in itself is a way to improve professionally. And I think over time, hopefully some of the partnerships will become, they can come off of Twitter, they can do video chats, they can meet in person. But I really love that so many text-based platforms like Twitter are making it possible for people to connect in ways that they might not otherwise have been able to.
Speaking of people who may be just first kind of getting their feet wet with mentoring, do you have any specific advice that you might be able to give out there to people that are finding themselves either in a mentoring position or, you know, that's sort of or wanting to get started there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that sometimes it's a very common misconception that if you're wanting to mentor someone, you have to be all the things to this one person. Like you are their whole professional career depends on you. And that's a lot of pressure. So the first thing I would tell people is to take a step back from that idea and try to start small and think that you have someone out there who's hoping to get a little bit further in their career. You, as someone who may be more experienced, have something to offer them, even something small. And so really honing in on what is it specifically that you feel that you're capable enough of coaching someone in. And something else that I feel many people are often surprised about by this is the idea that sometimes the things that you were not good at yourself, the failures that you had in your own career, those can very often be the areas where you are most qualified to mentor someone else. So I think part of it is being willing to take a look at when you may have gone through something that was a struggle for you. What was something that did not come easily to you? So go back to my example of that math lesson. I now coach people on time management. Who would have thought? It's because I know better now. But it's I would say start there and really think, what have I learned in my career that I can package up and help coach someone with? And when you start small, then that allows you to see the value that you're bringing. And from there, seek people out. Start on Twitter if you're looking to do it virtually. See if there's someone within your organization that you may be able to lend a hand to, especially if you're working in an organization that has any kind of internship or fellowship program. Often these are team members who this may be their very first real job, and they're like these little balls of clay that are being molded. And for better or worse, if you can be someone to step in and help someone, even if it's not a technical thing that you're assisting them with, helping them learn about things like how to speak up in meetings, how to present their ideas effectively, how to be able to collaborate better. All of these things have value, and the fact that you're able to present this to them, that is all mentoring. You know, you can scale it up even more and do a full-on official, like 6-month-long mentoring program with metrics and HR. You don't have to do that. There's a lot of value in that too. But my main takeaway is that I hope people can understand that even the little pieces, they qualify as mentoring, because ultimately someone's walking away from that learning and knowing more and being able to do more professionally than they could before.
Do you have any resources that you might be able to point people to?
Yeah, there's. I can share out those slides from my CodeMash talk. There were a number of resources at the end there. One in particular, the National Mentoring website. That's a great place to go if you're ever looking to get some initiatives started in your own organization. And another one that I love pointing people to, it's called SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management. If you're ever looking for any kind of human resourcey thing, SHRM is a great place to go because they can give a significant deal of guidance into if you are looking to do a more formal mentoring program. Here's what they have seen that works well and what may not work as well. Because when you talk about mentoring in a formal capacity, that's when you need to make sure that you have clear guidelines and metrics. You have sponsorship from someone in the organization. And with SHRM, they have seen all of that. And I rely very heavily on them whenever I'm trying to get some ideas and make sure that what I'm doing is aligning with their best practices.
Awesome. And then I know you've been attending, speaking at a number of conferences. Do you have anything more coming up here pretty soon that you'd like to plug?
Yeah, I like to call it the Olivia World Tour. coming up next. And let's see, we're almost in March. So in April, I'll be speaking at the Indico Conference in Indianapolis. It's being put on by the Amigala organization. I spoke at one of their other conferences last summer, Nebraska Code. And that is one of the conferences that I just, they do IndieCode, Nebraska Code, Prairie Code. If anyone is a junior developer in particular, this is like the buffet of knowledge that's there. There's so many different tracks to choose from. And I've got to say, of all the different conferences I've attended and spoken at, the Amagala ones, and including IndieCode, where I'll be speaking, very junior friendly. And it's amazing to see people walking around there not feeling as though they're intimidated or that they don't belong there. So that's what I really recommend. And then in May, I'll be speaking at the Women in Technology Summit here in Chicago. That is one I'm very excited about because my many of my female colleagues here from Cloud Bakers will be coming out there to cheer me on. I feel like it's like the Olympics and I've got the home team advantage here. But with that one, so for both of those conferences, I'll be giving a new talk that I've recently presented for the first couple times called Think Like a Trainer, Strategies for Improving Your Communication Skills. So all these things about communication and essentially it's taking a look at what I do as a technical trainer and how that can relate to helping programmers or anyone within tech become better at evaluating the situation, communicating with empathy. My favorite, explaining technical concepts in non-technical terms. And for a lot of this, I draw from my background in linguistic anthropology and philosophy. So it's I took quite a big risk as I was putting it together, and I thought, this is either going to be the best idea I've had or like people are going to walk out of this like, what are you talking about? But I recently presented that at the NDC London conference, and I gave one of the keynotes at Sunshine PHP in Miami and got amazing feedback on that. So it's been really rewarding to hear that the message is helping so many people learn how to communicate better.
Awesome. And how about if people want to just follow you a little bit? Do you have any like social media that you'd like to plug?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Oli Ravi. It's like ravioli, but flipped around. A fun fact, I've never had ravioli before in my life. My friends are constantly trying to fix that. But if you would like to follow me there, again, at Oli Ravi, I talk about all kinds of things. Conferences, security awareness, training for my next marathon at some point. So yeah, we'd love to have you join me there.
All right. Thanks, Olivia. Appreciate you coming on the show.
All right. Thank you all so much for having me.
That was Olivia Liddell. Olivia is a cloud training specialist at Cloud Bakers. She is a former Chicago public schools teacher who now specializes in technology training and change management. She is passionate about teaching, mentoring, and distance running.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.